Thank you, thank you for all of your hard work through the years and your courage and making it possible for us to have this gathering every summer. When I was about 10 years old, I began, to my mother's dismay, following my teenage brother and his friends around the neighborhood. One day, I watched them watch Nancy Owens, an older girl in the neighborhood, round the corner at the top of 11th Street. "Slut!" one of the boys yelled out as she disappeared over the hill in the direction of Pete Bird's grocery store. When I asked my brother what that word, slut, meant, he snickered and hemmed and hawed as the other boys jostled around him. Then finally came out with something about girls giving it up easy, and that if I didn't get on back home where I belonged, he was going to teach me a few more words I'd never heard of. Later, I asked my mother what it meant for a girl to give it up easy. When she finally regained composure, she responded in her usual wise and instructive way. "You shut your mouth, young lady, before I stomp the living daylights out of you." That was my sex talk. It wasn't until I had been writing and reading poems seriously for many years that I finally understood the full meaning of giving it up easy. Unfortunately, by that time, the good reputation my mother had so hoped and prayed for me was pretty much shot. So, poems are like the 1950s nice girls my mother spoke so often and fondly of, and that the best ones, like powerful poems, powerful dreams, don't give themselves up too easily, but yield slowly after having been courted with much patience, sensitivity, reverence, and care. No poet writing in modern English exemplifies this truth more than Gerard Manley Hopkins, the subject of my talk this morning. I discovered the poems of Gerard Manley Hopkins in high school by accident. Being a Smith, I always ended up alphabetized to the back of the room. My senior year, I had a teacher who was 125 years old. She stood at the front of the class and mumbled to the few students who were close enough to hear her and understand what she was saying. One day, I finally gave up. It was probably that first day. I started flipping through my literature book while she mumbled away at the front of the class, perusing the poems that were there. When I began reading the enigmatic poems of Gerard Manley Hopkins, I found myself falling head over heels in love with pure sound. Every day I would return to class and spend the hour reading again and again Hopkins' poems. Soon I had them memorized. Between classes I would walk down the halls amidst the opening and clanging shut of lockers, quietly reciting the wind over. "I caught this morning morning's minion, kingdom of daylight's dolphin, dappled dawn-drawn falcon and his riding of the rolling level underneath him steady air." Did I have any idea what those words meant? No. Did I get asked out on any dates in high school? No. And you wonder why? All I did know was that there was something going on inside those words that was working in me on the body, the heart, the soul level. So I'm grateful that that teacher or any other teacher ever assigned me those poems, asking me, as Billy Collins says in his delightful poem, Poetry 101, to tie them to a chair and beat a confession out of them. I love Larry Mays' talk on Monday morning. Is Larry here? Hi, Larry. That was you're always wonderful, but I love that talk, his statement that myth doesn't explain the mystery. It invites us into the mystery. Myth, dream, and poetry, art in general, all operate on the same principles. I look back on my high school experience of Hopkins' poems as a marvelous dream I entered into when I was 17. That dream has haunted me ever since, offering up every time I return to it another layer of meaning, of possibility. So I would like to now invite you into the myth, the dream, the mystery of the poetry of the inimitable Gerard Manley Hopkins. Now, later on, we're going to actually look together at the poems on the page, and even though I didn't intend for those handouts to be passed out, some of you have them, I would like for you just to sort of ignore them right now. And those of you who don't have them yet, we'll see if we can round up some for you when it comes time for us to look at them. So many of you have heard me say this before, but I agree with Robert Bly, who once said that when we read a poem on the page, we take it in here on the cerebral level. But when we hear it, we take it in here on the body, the heart, and the spirit level. So that's how I would like to invite you into the mystery, first of all, of these amazing poems. And just you might want to just close your eyes, just sort of find yourself drifting and floating on the language itself as I read to you a few poems by Gerard Manley Hopkins. God's grandeur. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, have trod, have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil. And wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, oh, morning, at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with bright wings. Embersnade. This darksome burn, horseback brown, his roll rock high road roaring down, in coop and in comb, the fleece of his foam flutes and low to the lake falls home. A windpuff bonnet of fawn froth turns and twindles over the broth of a pool so pitch black fell frowning, it rounds and rounds despair to drowning. Degged with dew, dappled with dew, are the groins of the braes that the brook treads through. Wiry heath paths, flitches of fern, and the big bonny ash that sits over the burn. What would the world be once bereft of wet and of wildness? Let them be left, oh, let them be left, wildness and wet. Long live the weeds and the wilderness yet. Yeah. spring and fall to a young child. Margaret, are you grieving over Golden Grove unleaving? Leaves, like the things of man, you with your fresh thoughts care for, can you? Ah, as the heart grows older, it will come to such sights colder by and by, nor spare a sigh, the whorls of one wood leaf will lie. And yet you will weep and know why. Now, no matter, child, the name, sorrow's springs are the same, nor mouth had, no, nor mind expressed, what heart heard of, ghost guessed. It is the blight man was born for. It is Margaret you mourn for. High beauty. Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple color as a brinded cow, for rolls, moles, all in stipple upon trout that swim, fresh fire-coal chestnut falls, finches wings, landscape plotted and pieced, fold fallow and plow, and all trades, their gear and tackle and trim, all things counter, original, spare, strange. Whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how? With swift, slow, sweet, sour, a dazzle, dim, he fathers forth whose beauty is past change. Praise him. The Wendover. I caught this morning morning's minion, kingdom of daylight's dolphin, dappled on drawn falcon in his riding of the rolling level underneath him steady air, and striding high there, how he rung upon the rein of a wimpling wing in his ecstasy, then off, off, forth on swing, as a skate's heel sweeps smooth on a bow bend, the hurl and gliding rebuffed the big wind, my heart in hiding stirred for a bird, the achieve of, the mastery of the thing. Brute beauty and valor and act, O air, pride, plume, gear, buckle, and the fire that breaks from thee then a billion times told lovelier, more dangerous, O my chevalier. No wonder of it, sheer plod makes plow down cilium shine, and blue bleak embers, ah, my dear, fall, gall themselves, and gash gold vermilion. Felix Randall. Felix Randall the farrier, oh, he is dead then, my duty all ended, who have watched his mold of man, big-boned and hearty handsome, pining, pining, till time when reason rambled in it, and some fatal four disorders fleshed there, all contended. Sickness broke him, impatient he cursed at first, but mended, being anointed and all, though a heavenlier heart began some months earlier, since I had our sweet reprieve and ransom tendered to him. Ah, well, God rest him all road ever he offended. This seeing the sick endears them to us. Us too it endears. My tongue had taught thee comfort. Touch had quenched thy tears. Thy tears that touched my heart, child, Felix, poor Felix Randall. How far from then forethought of all thy more boisterous years. When thou at the random grim forge, powerful amidst peers, didst fettle for the great gray dray horse his bright and battering sandal. So, Bob, do you have the exams back there? If you'll pass those out now, and Yeah, okay, thank you. Well, a little bit about our man Manly. That's what I came to call him. My man Manly. Gerard Manly Hopkins was born at Stratford, Essex in 1844 and died in 1889. So he was in essence a Victorian, but more than any other poet of the Victorian age, what Hopkins did with poetry created a bridge between the Victorian era and the modern era. So he is really considered one of the earliest modern English poets. He changed poetry. He was the eldest of eight children. His father was an insurance adjuster, of all things. They were a middle-class family. He had a couple of brothers who were artists. Gerard Manly Hopkins himself, at one point, wanted to be an artist. He went to Oxford, and when he was there, he was drawn to Catholicism. And because of his growing devoutness, he stopped writing poems because he felt that the things that he had been writing about were too worldly, and that he was giving his heart and himself to God and to Christ. And so he stopped writing poems for a while. And in 1875, a tragedy occurred. There was a ship called the Deutschland that was had gone into the mouth of the Thames River. It was full of a bunch of people, and especially five nuns who were being exiled from Germany because of the Falk laws. And as they entered the mouth of the Thames, a horrible storm arose, and there was a shipwreck, and many of the passengers died, and all five of the nuns who were being sent into exile died. This was a life-changing experience for Hopkins. And he shared with his superior how that event had moved him and how it struck him and how it haunted him. So his superior said, well, why don't you write a poem about it? So Hopkins did, and the poem was one of his longer poems called The Wreck of the Deutschland. I, of course, didn't read that today, but any of you who are interested in Hopkins might want to go back to that poem that really was a pivotal moment in his life. So he did write a poem called The Wreck of the Deutschland. And it's really both mostly a lyric poem, his reflections on spirituality, the nature of spirituality, God and Christ. But at some point, he actually tells the narrative in poetry of the wreck itself, and he focuses on the chief nun. And so in the poem, what the poem comes to is a merging together of his own conversion, because that he considered that event the thing that brought him fully to his conversion. So there is a coming together, a merging of his own conversion with the chief nun's transfiguring death. So that his main theme at that point became God's wrath and love. And so his poetry is a celebration through words of the bond between those two things, an attempt to hold the tension of God's wrath while also holding God's love. Very difficult thing to do, hold the tension of those two things. So in 1877, he was ordained a Jesuit priest. and he burned all of his early poems that he felt were too worldly. And he said that from there on out, what he really wanted to do was to merge the priest and the poet. But he would write only those poems that celebrated God and God's work in the world and in the human heart and the spirit. But again, he was always trying to balance and to merge the roles of priest and poet. So Hopkins' faith was itself a source of anguish. He said he never wavered in it, but never felt worthy of it. And many of his poems set anguish and rapture against each other. Anguish and rapture set against each other. So again, there's that tension that not only is he trying to recreate in his poems, but also asking the reader to hold those, that both that anguish and the rapture, to hold the tension of those two. His originality of style reflected his belief in the originality and uniqueness of every single one of God's creations. Every single one of God's creations is unique, is different, is special, is strange in a wonderfully strange way. So he wanted his poems to show that same kind of originality, to recreate God's creation of that originality in everything. And so that's why his poems seem so weird. That was a deliberate thing. He thought that the difficulty of composition was a means of achieving poetic value, as the difficulty of spiritual exercises was productive of higher qualities within the self. I've often heard students say, why did he make his poems so confusing? Why did he try to hide what it was he was trying to say? But actually, Hopkins' intention was to do the opposite. He said his verse was intended to elicit the special identity of a thing, releasing its private energy and conveying the specialness of it. He even coined a word for this specialness, and the word is inscape. Just sort of think of what we usually, the word landscape is what we use for that thing that's outside of us, the landscape. So he's doing a play on that word. We inscape. So what he's trying to do in his poems is to shine a light on that inscape in everything in God's creation. So there's a flame in everything that is a spark of the divine. It's a spark of the divine. And it's that thing's originality and that thing's connection to God. And everything has it. Everything has it. So what he's trying to do is to shine a light and to reveal that originality to the reader. That little flame in the divine that everything has inside. The only problem is that language fails us. Language fails us. And so he searched beyond the language that he had at his fingertips to try to shine a light on that originality, that inscape in all of God's creation. So he would since the words that he had available didn't work, he would often resort to words that were no longer in use, archaic words, because he felt that somehow they had connotations that in our, that even in our use, if we did even use a form of them, we had lost their original connotations. So he would go back to the vernacular. So there would be archaic words, like you might have heard the word psyllium. Sheer plod makes plow down psyllium. Do you remember that one? Shine, psyllium. That's an archaic word. We'll talk a little bit more about it in a minute. Fettle, in the wonderful poem Felix Randall, and the last line, he talks about when how he would fettle with the horses, the horseshoe, beating it, pounding it into being for the horse. He would fettle with it. Fettle, meaning an archaic word, meaning to get ready. We use that word all the time. We do. Let me fiddle with it. Let me fiddle with it. I thought it was spelled F-I-D-D-L-E. Fettle. Burl. You know, and when he couldn't, when even those words failed him, he would just make up words. Leaf mill, bloom fall, beach bowl, unleaving. So no wonder those people who demand, who really would like to tie Hopkins' coins to a chair and beat a confession out of them, they're going to have a hard time. They're going to have a hard time. So even traditional metrics failed him. All right, now, I even hate to start talking about this right now, but I am anyway. If you find your eyes glazing over, I beg you, do not leave. What's the touchstone, Bob? When you don't know what's going on, revert to wonder. Say that again, Rose. Return to wonder. Do not leave because I'll start crying. The entire conference will be ruined and it'll be your fault. So, okay, I promise you I'm not going to spend much time on this, but there's what's called standard rhythm. Remember back to your high school teacher who was mumbling at the top of the class, front of the class? Remember she was saying things like iambic, trochaic, dactylic, and anapestic? Those are the standard rhythms. Those are standard rhythms that poets would either use, the iambic, the trochaic, the anapestic, or the dactylic. Well, he decided that those did not give him enough freedom to express both either that rapture, either the anguish, the depth of anguish, or the height of rapture. Those standard rhythms just did not do it. So he invented, just as he invented a word inscape, he invented a new rhythm, a way of putting the words together in syllabics and so forth, and he called it sprung rhythm. He actually sprung it from the bounds of what other poets had been doing. So, for instance, let's see. All right, this is going to be fun. Who remembers how many feet 1 foot of iambic pentameter would have in it? 5 feet, but each foot would have how many syllables? 2. So a line of iambic pentameter poetry would have 10 syllables. 5 unstressed syllables and 5 stressed syllables. Da-da, 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 da-da. You're still with me. Thank you. Okay, well, he decided that, you know, there were times when that just did not express the energy or even the quietness that he needed to express. So he sprung that. In other words, he would still try to have 5 stressed syllables, but he didn't care where they were. Sometimes he would jam all 5 stressed syllables up against each other. Now, I would like to ask you, as you heard me reading, could you tell sometimes where my voice went up like that and stayed up there? That's what was going on. That was some sprung rhythm for you. I know you can't wait to get back home and just share this, you know, just... you know, you're gonna meet your friends for cocktails and just at some moment just say, how about that sprung rhythm? Mm-hmm. So, he said that his poetry was really, he said, my verse is less to be read than heard. Because sometimes for him, he was so incapable of expressing meaning, the only way he could do it was through sound itself. Sound itself. For instance, there is a difference, the sounds of vowels, there is a whole scale of vowel sounds that go up like a music scale. They have different frequencies of energy. The lowest energy vowel sound is oo. Oo. It's soothing, it's calming, it can also give a sense of dread or sadness, so it's lower. And then as we move up that scale, we get all the way up to the highest frequency sound, which is E. That's the highest frequency. And that wonderful poem, the Wendover, O air, pride, plume, here. As you say that, you feel the frequencies in your body rising. And if you could, this is a physical thing, not just an emotional thing. As a matter of fact, if I could hook you up to, I call it a seismograph, but I realize that's not the right word. That has to do with earthquakes, right? What would it be, like an EKG? What is the thing? A what? Yeah, that's what I was getting ready to say. I just couldn't think of the right words. Anyway, and if I read you vowel sounds in that low frequency, the oohs and the ohs and the ahs, there would be, and we graphed it, the graph would be something like this. And then as I moved up that scale of frequency, it would get more jagged and more erratic because it's doing something to the body itself. And sound actually can change the brain. And I'm talking about the physical brain. So, okay, now, see, Bob, I can't see that clock. I'm trying to, 10 o'clock. All right, okay, so, all right, now I am nervous. So, do you have poems in front of you now? If there's a stack, if you'll pass them, and then there's a few more, I tried to make enough. Okay, and if you don't have one, maybe just look with somebody. Just first, I wish we could reread every poem and talk about what's going on in the poem without feeling again that we had to do that. You know, just. I would like for you to fall in love with the mystery, with the sound of these poems, and also think in terms of it, you know, as we say about with our dreams. Our dreams also, you know, poetry is very like dreams. We're not going to tie them to a chair and beat a confession out of them. You know, I'm still in the dream of Hopkins poetry. And I love being in the dream of it, but that doesn't mean that I'm not also delighted when I have a realization or an insight or actually understand what it is he might be trying to say. But, for instance, if you look at God's grandeur, is that the first poem? Okay. So in this poem, he actually combined, the first stanza of the poem is an expression of anguish. Anguish. And then he changes stanzas, and the last stanza, he moves to rapture. So, you know, if nothing else, as you reread this poem on your own, feel the anguish of the first part of that poem. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook oil. Now, he's talking about the instep, right? That thing in everything in God's creation. It will flame out like shining from shook oil. Now, those of you who are thinking, if my mom used to call it aluminum foil, wasn't invented then. So it couldn't have been that, but he's actually talking about gold leaf, which comes in sheets also. And if you shake it, it's very thin, even thinner than aluminum foil. But that's his image there. That, like the ooze of oil, crushed olive, as olive oil, as olives are being crushed, and how the oil oozes out of it, and it increases the speed the more oil that is crushed out of it. And so, but then he moves this question, why do we not pay attention to that? Why do we not wreck his rod? So there's he's anguishing over what human beings are doing to this creation. And yet, he moves into that wonderful second stanza, and for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And if you look at that final line, the world broods with warm breast and with bright wings. In that final, at the end of that poem, we're given three stresses back to back, and that was not heard of in standard rhythm. A single stress by itself, accompanied by an unstress or two unstress, is what you got. But this is his strong rhythm, because he wanted that ecstasy there at the end. He wanted our voices and our bodies to feel that ecstasy. Another thing, too, monosyllabic words. I always found that it was odd that the word monosyllabic is a five-syllable word, meaning one syllable. Monosyllabic words carry a lot more energy. They're charged than multisyllabic words. The more syllables you have in a word, the softer. It's a softening. So look at that last line in this poem, where his energy, where he wants to really get that energy. What do you notice? They're all monosyllabic words, all monosyllabic words. In person aid, just a little something that'll give you something to hook on to, a little meaning. Inversnaid is actually a waterfall in Scotland that he visited, and just was really taken with the beauty and the power of it. And so all he's doing here, you talk about just loving a poem for sound, his roll rock high road roaring down, and cooping and comb like the fleece of his foam, flutes and low to the lake falls home. Just say it. Who cares what it means? But you know, your voice is doing what a waterfall does. It's exactly what it's doing. Long live the weeds and the wilderness. Here's an example of his making up words. Roll rock. His roll rock, high road, roaring down. In cooping and comb, he's turning nouns into verbs, meaning when water is both contained in coop and in comb, when it's combing over the waterfalls. And however the water is, whether it's contained or flowing, there's this magic to it. There's this spirit to it. So spring and fall is just such a beautiful, beautiful poem, which, you know, really is an anguished poem. It is Margaret you mourn for. It's just gorgeous. And then Pied Beauty seems to be all rapture, just this celebration of the originality of things. And the irony there at the end of Pied Beauty, he has just finished praising all of these fickle, spotted, speckled variations and things, and the paradox, he fathers forth whose beauty is past change. Praise him. And then the Wendover, Hopkins himself said that this was the best thing that he had ever done. And it's probably the most confusing poem that he's ever done, because there are all kinds of metaphors. You know, Larry also talked about that myths and dreams both speak in the language of metaphor. And so this is what Hopkins is doing also. This poem is dedicated to Christ our Lord. And so he's comparing some of what he's doing is, as he sees this bird who's actually flying into the wind, and the power that is being emanated as this beautiful bird flies into the wind. And in line 3, as you say that, of the rolling level underneath him steady air, of the rolling level underneath him steady air, your voice feels as if it's that bird bouncing along on the air beneath it. I actually, when I was studied at Oxford, the summer of 84, I think, I would spend every afternoon out on the quad at Exeter College reading Gerard Manley Hopkins and drinking Guinness Stout. Now, I'm not saying the Guinness Stout had anything to do with it, but I looked up every word, and some of the words I couldn't find. So, you know, those of you who really would like to do more with Hopkins, just go as far as you want to go. Those of you who just are okay with being in the mystery of his poems and love the sound, I invite you to stay in that mystery, memorize some of the words so that you'll have them in your body, and that in itself is enough, just as even though we are here to look more closely at our dreams and to interact more with our dreams, if nothing else, you know, just the dream itself. Wake up in the morning and let yourself just stay in the dream and the images. That in itself is huge. So I say that, as I said earlier, poetry, myth, dreams, any art in general, they're all acting on the same principles, and they can just make our lives so rich, even if we don't understand what the hell it's all about. Now, Bob helped me this morning. There's a wonderful YouTube that we're not going to be able to show, and this will be the final thing that I leave with, but you might want to... And maybe it's better that we didn't get to hear Richard Burton reading God's Grandeur. You know, I know. I tried. But I'm hoping that we're going to hear Natalie Merchant singing his lovely song, Spring and Fall, to a young child. And you might want to just...
I'll do is called Spring and Fall to a Young Child by Judy Lindley Hopkins. Judy Lindley Hopkins was a Jesuit priest, and he took his vows at the age of 24 and burned all the poetry that he had written in his youth at that time. And didn't really pursue publication of his poems. That was left to a friend of his, Robert Bridges, after he died. He died of typhoid fever when he was 44 years old. So he gave up writing poetry for about 7 years after he took his vows, but then wrote quite secretly after that. And this is from the collection of poetry that he wrote before his death. It's addressing a young girl named Margaret and talking about death quite beautifully to her.
Margaret, are you grieving over Golden Grove? I'm leaving by and by. Leaves like the things of man you, with your fresh loved care for. Margaret, that you mourn for.